Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we always talk about A Course in Miracles and generally about spirituality, but certainly our jumping off point, our platform is A Course in Miracles here on Friday. So today is July 20th, 2018, and on today's show, I do have my friend and colleague, Bruce Rawls, who is an ACIM teacher, an ACIM student. He's a web designer. He's a writer. He does all kinds of stuff. And he's just, it feels like he weaves A Course in Miracles into almost everything he does because he actually works on a number of the websites for organizations based in A Course in Miracles. So Bruce is here with me today. And when we were discussing what we're going to talk about, he suggested a line that is really a theme that runs throughout A Course in Miracles. And it's nothing so blinding as perception of form. Now, of course, that sounds like a mouthful. We're going to talk more about it. You'll find that exact statement in chapter 22 when we're talking about responsibility for sight. But of course, as you'll see, this has a whole lot more to do with interpretation. In fact, as we get into our discussion, I think I'll read just a little bit of chapter 21, or actually not chapter 21, but something Ken Wapnick said about chapter 21, because I just thought it was really, really telling. But you will find that statement, and I can read that too. Nothing so blinding as perception of form. You'll find it in chapter 22. So before we begin our discussion, though, I want to invite everybody to join those of you who are already in the chat room this morning. We do have a private group over on Facebook where you'll find Greg and Renee and me and other people coming into that room. So thank you, everybody, for being there early this morning. But the way you get there, if you want to come on over to Facebook and join us and you don't know where that page is, the best way to find it is to go to our radio website. You go to 12radio.com. Look on the left side of the page. That's the navigation pane. And you will see chat. When you click on chat, you'll be automatically redirected over to Facebook. And then you can ask to join our group. And Scott is there today. And he is, you know, ready to let you in the door with a secret password, which, of course, is just let me in. So thanks for being here today, Scott. And and everybody. Oh, and I see Terry is coming into the room too. Thank you so much. I love seeing you, you know, in the room. And even though we don't often, you know, sometimes we answer questions or sometimes we do refer to what's going on over there. I try to, but, you know, I'm kind of limited in my focus. So I do appreciate all your comments and please feel free to make comments and I will try to keep an eye on it today. And so let's get started with Bruce Rawls. Hey, Bruce, thanks for being here today.
Hi, CA and all. Thank you for inviting me, as always. I always enjoy our conversations immensely.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate so much. I love bouncing ideas off other people, and I love hearing what other people are thinking about or kind of what's in their face, what's their curriculum. And so I do always like to start the show by asking if you recommended or suggested something, what was it about this idea that's kind of been in part of your curriculum or your life lately?
Oh, wow.
Everything?
probably everything. Yeah. Yeah. Really, I mean, in a sense, it is everything because the entire, you know, world is a propaganda machine. I mean, I could certainly kind of go through a laundry list of recent events and the dream saga of Bruce, but, you know, singling out a particular one, I'd have to, you know, think about something that maybe stands out. But if I really just look at everything that happens in a given day, there's always, you know, moment to moment, you know, a choice between two thought systems, and one of them is completely enthralled with form and appearances, and the other is basically the way out of the nightmare that other thought system suggests, and that's to forgive ourselves for believing that our identity is invested in, you know, this craziness of a limited, separated self. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing specific crosses my mind at the moment, but I, you know, really, you could pick anything. I think that's why those early workbook lessons are so helpful, because they basically teach us right from the get-go to generalize and to just look at whatever specific things happen, you know, or appear to you moment to moment and say, well, the form doesn't mean anything. And we've given the forms all the meaning that they have for us. And, you know, our thoughts about the forms don't mean anything. But there's a meaning that's behind everything that suddenly becomes crystal clear once we switch teachers, once we switch from the teacher of separation to the teacher of inclusion, the teacher of what the Course calls sin, guilt, and fear, and death, and dissolution, and dissociation, and all that craziness, and switch over to the awareness that we took with us into the dream that we never really left, but we've just masked over with a lot of stuff. That reminds us that our true nature really is complete innocence, and we all are that and have that, and complete oneness. We don't get to the oneness directly, though. Usually, we kind of have to go through by way of sameness. But we can look at the forms. We can use the forms that appear in our life as our classroom, and so form becomes. It's a very Platonic thing, as a quick aside, in terms of, you know, Plato's ideal of thinking that, you know, the specific form isn't the important thing. It's really the idea behind it. And I think that alludes to the idea that what we really are is this perfection. But we don't have any recognition of that until we learn to use the specifics to get back to, well, what's it all for? You know, that we kind of like the little annoying kid in the third grade class, you know, why? You know, well, why am I seeing what I'm seeing? Well, it's because I've chosen one of two teachers, and I've either chosen the teacher of form or the teacher of content. And the teacher of form, aka ego, is always looking at the superficial and seeing a meaningless array of things that don't seem to relate to each other, and that certainly don't relate to my mind, because they're things that just happen to me, right? Mm-hmm. That's the, you know, the default mode that we work with as egos, but it never is satisfying, and it never really makes us happy. So that's why Helen Schuckman and Bill Thetford, you know, had this conversation several decades ago. It was like, there must be a better way. There must be another approach that leads us out of this, you know, meaningless assortment of miscellaneous grievances and victimhoods and you know, the huge variety of things that seem to beset us from outside. And the way we turn it around is by seeing that they're really reflections of a decision in the mind that we can undo. We can choose once again to see beyond the forms of error. So it might actually be useful to read a little bit of that section. What do you think, Sia?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But actually, can I read something?
Of course.
I want to read just one paragraph that Ken wrote about chapter 21, which of course comes before chapter 22. And this is from the section, The World Projection Makes Perception.
Yes.
And he says, we begin this section with the responsibility for sight, frequently cited by course students, albeit incorrectly, in saying we are responsible for what we see. Jesus refers to how we see. Perception is interpretation. Perception is not what our eyes see in the world outside, but the mind's interpretation of what they see. Mm-hmm. The ego's purpose of furthering the dream of separation, or the Holy Spirit's purpose of awakening us from the nightmare of guilt and fear. And I think that's such I just wanted to kind of introduce that right up front. You already had said that, you know, when it comes back to it, what is the purpose? Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to introduce that idea that when we're talking about perception here, Ken is laying it out. It's very clear. He's not saying what your eyes are seeing. He's talking about what is your mind interpreting about what your eyes are seeing.
Exactly.
You know, so this isn't about, you know, here again, you know, when Ken says be normal, it's not about saying, I do not see that. I do not see that. I do not see that. It's not about saying, yeah, that tree isn't there, or this, you know, it's right. About changing your interpretation. And your interpretation is always going to be based on your purpose.
Yep.
If your purpose is to further the separation, then that's how your perception is going to be developed. And also, you said a word that I thought was so important. In fact, you know, it kind of gave me chills. Let's put it that way. And when I say that, you know, as a psychic, that's the kind of thing when I hear something and I kind of get chills. I go, that's it. That's what we need to talk about. Or that's, for me, what I need to stick with from this conversation. And that is, you talked about innocence. And the reason I think that's important is because, once again, it goes back to purpose. Uh-huh. And I always say, you know, we pay a lot of lip service to we are one and we're in this together. And sometimes we can't quite get that. But, you know, kind of backtrack and think, if you made it your purpose today to see innocence in other people, mm-hmm. you know, innocence, you know, use that as your foundation. No matter what you hear about anybody or what's going on with anybody, how would your response be different if you assumed that person was innocent and you are innocent, rather than automatically attributing some malicious intent or whatever? So I thought, you know, that just kind of resonated with me. And I thought, that's my word for the day.
Yeah.
Maybe my word for the week is, can I assume that the basis is we are innocent? And so I want my perception to run along those lines. And there again, it's a difference between teachers. Am I assuming innocence or am I assuming guilt? Am I looking for guilt? And we don't have to look very far to know that most of us, especially our media, is always looking for guilt.
Right.
You know, who's to blame in this situation? Who did it wrong? You know,
yeah.
So in any case, I just wanted to say that. And sure, now let's go ahead and where are you reading from?
Oh, actually, what you just said kind of had a little light bulb moment or two for me, because as you're saying that, I was thinking, well, you know, sometimes, because we live in a dualistic system, sometimes our religious traditions and even political institutions, you know, get things right, you know, or momentarily stumble upon the truth, as it were. And I was thinking that, you know, what you were saying kind of is like, you know, harkens to, you know, the cliche of the rule of law in this country, at least, of innocent until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, I think, has some tremendous implications on a spiritual level. Now, obviously, on a behavioral level, you know, we're never talking about behavior or form again, since we're talking about form in this hour. But the metaphysics of A Course in Miracles is always and only about the mind, and particularly, it reminds us that those two thought systems are completely exclusive, and the thought system, the ego, is always about guilt and whether or not it purports to be, you know, leading toward innocence. Its real motivation, its real purpose, is really always driving back to the idea that we're guilty and we need to punish ourselves and mm-hmm. therefore drag everyone down with us, you know?
Right. Or pushing the guilt out.
Exactly.
You know, if I can make you more guilty than me, then right. I look better.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know?
And then there's
yeah.
some of those challenging lines like, behold me, brother, at your hands I die, and all those kind of things that you know, talk about the whole nature of projection and victimhood and how we don't want that guilt to be in us. So we you know, try to project it out. But yeah, the innocent until proven guilty idea, I think, is actually a profoundly helpful one. And really, of course, Miracles is taking it a step further. It's innocent, and the only thing that attempts to prove guilt is the ego. Now, again, we're talking only about the mind. We're only talking about our true nature, our essence, our spirit, and it has nothing to do with the dream figures that in space and time that we call our personal selves with our personas on our bodies. It's not about that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But we need those triggers. We need that classroom to get back to the mind. And we need the specifics of the things that either cause us outrage or sadness or depression or jealousy or feelings of victimhood or, you know, all that, the whole gamut of what we consider negative emotions. Those really become the gifts that we give ourselves, not that we go out actively looking for them. I mean, we don't have to. There's usually plenty in the course of a day to fill our in basket. But
yeah.
We just kind of take all, you know, which kind of kind of ties into your opening question. He's like, Whitney, what's been going on in your life? Well, I think all we have to do is just look at all the specifics, you know, and take each instance that comes to us, appears to come from to us from the outside in a given day, and say, what is the form of this? Okay, now I can use the form, and instead of accepting ego's interpretation, I can look at Holy Spirit's translation and see a different purpose, which is I can use this specific thing for forgiveness. I can use this to forgive myself for believing that there's something outside myself that needs some kind of repair. And the only repair that's needed is my decision for a crazy thought system that made guilt possible. Seemed possible.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just thinking, too, just going along those lines of the guilty thing. I've said this before, but, you know, I have these visions in my head that, you know, I always go back to from time to time. And I often see the world, or I see my life, as a play on a stage. And that's a visual that really comes from a course. But what I do when I'm particularly, like, I have a really, really hard time dealing with somebody's behavior, I literally see the end of the play when everybody's all lined up and they're taking their bows.
Yes.
And I literally, I mean, and like, for instance, I do this with politicians a lot, you know.
Great idea.
They're all lined up on the stage and, you know, the announcers say, and playing the part of the villain, you know, and the person steps forward and everybody's clapping and cheering and the person is taking their bow. And, you know, sometimes it just helps, especially when I'm just up against, I'm so frustrated or I'm so angry because my perception is this person is so guilty. And so then I just remember that visual and I put everybody up on the stage and it's like, oh my God, what a great villain they're playing. You know, they're doing an excellent job.
I love that. See, a line from, I'm probably going to paraphrase and botch, but something like our revels now are over, you know, and these actors, you know, yada, yada. I forget how it goes. But anyway, but, you know, it's basically, yeah, I'm that image of standing on the stage and taking a bow, all holding hands, all working together to create a drama that seems so convincing. And yet it's just a dramatization. It's just an idea that of something that given tremendous believability in our mind only, and that's what the metaphysics of A Course in Miracles and who knows how many countless pure non-dual metaphysical systems that have come before it have suggested, that is, you know, this dreamlike surreal space-time is just that. It's just a massive holographic stage of tremendous proportions that apparent tremendous proportions.
Yeah.
And modern physics has some things to say about that, but you know, it's just really a facade that we've used to obscure the innocence that we all have and share in a way that seems very convincing. But, you know, if we, like, I love that metaphor and that visualization of, you know, all actors on the stage at the end of the production looking back on the silliness of what they've just reenacted and taking a bow, holding hands together. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it helps me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because there are sometimes just that idea of innocence. And there again, nothing so blinding as a perception of form. It, you know, when we're talking about innocence, we're not talking about on a behavioral level.
Right. Exactly.
We're not saying that somebody hasn't done something or that they don't, that there's no discipline that needs to be exerted or nothing that needs to be changed. We're talking on a spiritual level, on the value of this human being, of this person. Right. But, you know, so they're not all innocent. And you don't just, you know, or you don't let kids run wild, you know, or whatever.
Exactly.
It is.
Or politicians.
You know, or politicians. We, you know, we don't just throw up our hands and say there's nothing to be done. But on the other hand, when I just can't deal with it, I mean, it just is overwhelming, mind-boggling. Like I said, I pull out my stage and I clap for everybody. And like I said, I announce them as they come out. And the villain or the whatever and the... the murderer, they're this or that, you know, and everybody claps and everybody's having a good time, because I just have to pull that out in order to somehow cope. It's one of my, it's in my spiritual toolbox. It's one of my coping mechanisms. Mm,
that's a great one. That really is an excellent one. Thank you again for that.
You are welcome.
Should we start reading from chapter 22 a little bit?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that sounds good. And tell me where, in fact, I'm just calling it up now.
Actually, I'm thinking paragraph 4 might be a good place to start. I mean, we could start at the beginning of chapter 22, section 3, but maybe skipping to paragraph 4.
Okay.
That kind of jumped out at me. And it goes, only the form of error attracts the ego, meaning it does not recognize and it does not see it if it is there or not. Does not see if it is there or not. Everything the body's eyes see is a mistake, an error in perception, a distorted fragment of the whole without the meaning that the whole would give. So just by default, because we see only a tiny, tiny, super tiny fragment of even the so-called physical material cosmos, we obviously don't get the whole picture. We don't even get, as a first approximation, anything. You know, we're basically, for all intents and purposes, blind and deaf and dumb.
Yeah.
If we use the world's data at face value and interpret it as such, I think that's what the whole point of this is. And it goes on, and yet mistakes, regardless of their form, can be corrected. Sin is but error in a special form the ego venerates. And again, harks back to that thing that I learned from Neil Douglas Klotz, who's an Aramaic scholar, who's talking about how the word evil in Aramaic was actually correctly translated as immature, unripe, and I think that's where, you know, the sin in conventional religious jargon has extra baggage to it, that error. It makes it just like, oh, well, it's just a simple mistake that has no, you know, emotional baggage needed, because you can back out of a cul-de-sac once you recognize you're in a cul-de-sac and get on the thoroughfare again. But if you further, you know, distract yourself and delude yourself into thinking, oh, well, now I'm stuck and I am this horrible, you know, home of evil, darkness, and sin, because I, you know, wasn't following my GPS and turned into this cul-de-sac. Now I'm doomed to suffer here forever and never progress. Well, no, that's not true. But that's the ego strategy, is to basically take error and turn it into sin. And that was one of the first things that, when I started reading A Course in Miracles back in the mid '80s, it was like, oh my gosh, that is so powerful, because if sin is an optional, really misunderstanding, misinterpretation of error, then our forgiveness classroom can undo that. That's where we can look at everything that comes into our lives, including all the decisions that we appear to have made in this world and those of others, and say, oh, okay, nothing has happened that affects our eternal, immortal, untouchable, unchangeable innocence. And you know, beauty and purity and perfection. Mm-hmm. Nothing could have possibly ever compromised those or threatened those in any way, that those qualities in us. And the actors on the stage reflect that. You know, they were portraying all these things that were crazy, nonsensical, you know, and hopefully hilarious parodies of what our real life is. And I think that's why. You know, this line really, to me, is one of many that are really helpful. So I'll start from there again.
Sin okay, but wait, can oh, you, before you do, I just want to repeat what you said.
Okay.
You said in Aramaic, evil means unripe, immature.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's my understanding.
That. Love that. I think that is profound.
Yeah.
You know, and it ties into, I had put this in an email to you, that I thought this whole topic really is nice on the heels of what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks, which is, don't judge because you're not good at it.
Yes.
And the idea that you can't possibly have the whole picture.
Yeah.
That's what this paragraph is saying.
Yes.
You don't have the whole picture. It's unripe. It's immature. Mm-hmm. All the pieces aren't there. What you're seeing is only a small part.
Right.
So thank you for that. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, it's incomplete because another metaphor that I really like that I almost started with a moment ago is the magic eye posters. Again, if we look at a two-dimensional print of these, if you're familiar with the magic eye, also called stereograms, these posters that were popular a number of years ago, they look typically like a whole bunch of random dots and kind of amorphous blobs that don't mean anything or say anything. And it's only with a little bit of training, you know, some people get it and some people, you know, have never, you know, done the eye focusing trick to make these things work. And that is to basically, you have to focus past the plane of the paper or the print or the image on your screen, whatever it happens to be. And to see the three-dimensional image that is encoded in those stereograms and those magic eye posters, because the content is really there, but the form that's in the two-dimensional shapes doesn't mean anything. So I think it's a great metaphor that we have to look past the form. We have to look past, in this case, the two-dimensional metaphor to see the three-dimensional content in that image. And that's, I think that's, again, sort of analogous to the ego venerates the form because it basically keeps us trapped and we think we need punishment from the ego's perspective because of not seeing the whole picture. And so we blame ourselves for that, for something that's really only made up. But the Holy Spirit says, well, there's a bigger picture here. And if you get more of the picture, you'll start to begin to see that condemnation and judgment is not necessary. In fact, it's very counterproductive. And that's where the forgiveness comes in, to just train our mind to see that that evil is not a correct interpretation or sin, but the error is very helpful. And seeing the error, in fact, is crucial because we'll never see that what the big picture is unless we recognize the error and then move beyond it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. And thanks for the reminder about those stereograms. Is that what you called them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's a perfect example of you look at something and – but then if you look a certain way, you see something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to learn how to see it.
You do. And for some people, it's almost instantaneous. Others, like you know, you give them these books or the posters and they say, what? Wow, I still don't see it. I'll still see it. And then finally, sometimes you'll hear people, you know, a month or a year later say, oh, I finally figured it out. I like sort of defocused on the plane of the paper and looked past it a little, you know, a few inches kind of thing. And there it popped, it just jumped out at me.
There it was. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the same feeling that you have when you suddenly realize, wait a minute, I've been needlessly beating myself up, needlessly condemning myself for a crime that I never committed. And that's the ontological metaphysics of A Course in Miracles to a T, right? I mean, that's the whole premise, that we took a tiny mad idea seriously, believing that we're in exile, and we're basically self-imprisoned in this little flatland two-dimensional world that we don't have to be in. And there's this much greater, vaster, more wonderful and totally inclusive reality that we all are and have and share, that it beckons to us inexorably, kind of like lesson 182. You know, it's almost like we're, you know, a little kid who's wandered off and into this strange land, and we know that we can get back home, but we don't know how. But there's something within us that knows that there's something better. There's a way home. There's a way out, and that way is always some form. You know, it's not the form, but it's some variety of forgiveness that gets us back moment to moment to that place in our mind, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, we just click those ruby slippers together and say, "There's no place like home."
Yeah, exactly.
We always had the power to do it.
Yeah, I love Wizard of Oz as far as all the metaphors in that one too. We could spend a whole hour on that one. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead and read.
Okay, I'll give it one more try on that. Listen,
I won't interrupt you.
Oh no, not a problem. I think we're covering some good ground here. Okay, sin is but error in a special form the ego venerates. It would preserve all errors and make them sins. For here is its own stability, its heavy anchor in the shifting world it made, the rock on which its church is built and where its worshipers are bound to bodies, believing the body's freedom is their own. And at best, we have a few liberties in this world to, you know, change our zip code or our you know, terrestrial address, you know, here and there. And even if we're you know, bon vivant world travelers, there's still, you know, most of us are still pretty much stuck to this planet. And, not that it's a horrible planet, but it's you know, kind of like Richard Bach said, any number is a limit. And anything that's less than perfect oneness is not going to satisfy us. Mm. And that's why, you know, kind of harkening back to that lesson 182, which was part of my reading in Ken's The Journey Home this morning. Thanks again, CA, for reminding me to look in that book, because that's such a wonderful – I'm about half.
Oh, my God. It is such a great book, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. That lesson that says, you know, we know there's something better here. We know that on some level or another that this is not what we're entitled to, you know, and therefore, you know, we can afford to give ourselves and each other so much slack, and that's when the real freedom comes back to our mind. Any other comments before we read the next paragraph or two?
No, let's go on.
Okay, do you want to read the fifth one?
Sure. Okay. Reason will tell you that the form of error is not what makes it a mistake. If what the form conceals is a mistake, the form cannot prevent correction. The body's eyes see only form. They cannot see beyond what they were made to see. And they were made to look on error and not see past it. Theirs is indeed a strange perception, for they can see only illusions, unable to look beyond the granite block of sin and stopping at the outside form of nothing. To this distorted form of vision, the outside of everything, the wall that stands between you and the truth is wholly true. Yet how can sight that stops at nothingness as if it were a solid wall see truly? It is held back by form, having been made to guarantee that nothing else but form will be perceived.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot in that, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I just, even there again, those visuals, the granite form,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it goes back to purpose or thinking that the eyes have powers that they don't have.
Yeah. 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 The solidness of the appearances of form, are really convincing. I mean, as a propaganda machine, space-time is, I mean, it just, it's a testament to how powerful our minds really are, that we could actually make something that is like this Matrix movie of unquestionably profound, highly convincing, you know, holographic stuff that looks, feels, tastes, touches everything, all the senses and beyond, just completely real. And we have, you know, developed, you know, all these various sciences that can measure the very tiny and the very large and different spectrums of light and sound and you know, all these, you know, disciplines ways of slicing and dicing this alleged reality that seem to corroborate things that don't change. I think that's kind of what got me, you know, back into metaphysics in this lifetime, is I always want to know, what doesn't change?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the things that don't change in a long term still ultimately change in, you know, the ultimate long term, you know, because galaxies come and go, you know, that's what even science tells us that. So if the things that we think of as solid walls and impenetrable problems in a world that seems very real are in truth nothing compared to the reality of spirit that we all are, it's going to take a little work, that identification, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I was just thinking, you're the perfect person in some ways to talk about a lot of this because of your training, your experience, what you've written about, because – you know, as human beings, over and over and over again, we are taught that what we see with our eyes isn't true. I mean, think about the whole concept of the world is flat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the world is flat. If I am only using my eyes, the world is flat. But right. I know through it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Or things like one of the funny ones that I always go back to is I've never seen a calorie. You know, ever have I seen a calorie.
And or yet, an electron, for that matter, yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen any of these things. That, yeah. And yet, you know, I would kind of be a fool, I guess I would say that. I say, well, there's no such thing as calories. And so quit counting them and quit looking at them and quit thinking about them. You know, it's like it doesn't take much to that using your eyes as the, you know, kind of the truth barometer mm-hmm. is craziness.
Absolutely.
You know, because yeah. physics, I mean, all of these things that are going on that, you know, or like, for instance, this is a silly one, but recently I had a water leak. And one of the keys that it was happening wasn't where it was happening, but it was like pretty far away from it because I have hardwood floors. And I'll tell you what was happening is that water was being absorbed by the hardwood floors underneath the stove, underneath the refrigerator. And it wasn't until it got outside of those two things and, you know, I could see the floor was wet. And there again, not pools of water, but the wood itself was wet. And I'm like, how can the wood be wet? And you know, so my, you know, what makes sense to me is I didn't spill water here.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what's happening is what looks like solid hardwood. That's what we call it, right? Solid mm-hmm. hardwood. No, that solid hardwood is actually very, very porous.
Mm-hmm.
And so water is able to absorb all the way across the floor to a place that I could actually see it.
Yeah.
But, you know, once again, I mean, the whole thing just it was such a reminder of it doesn't matter what you see because, you know, or what you see may not be the interpretation. The water, you know, the water problem is not right here on the floor. The problem is someplace else, you know, just like the problem is in our minds, uh-huh. you know. It wouldn't have helped me at all to put a towel on the floor where I was seeing water damage. I had to find the source of the problem.
Bingo. Yeah,
and exactly. That's what we do in our minds all the time. So, yeah, our eyes are helpful, but we need to know they have limits. And so, no, your eyes are not going to see a calorie. Your eyes are not going to see an electron. You know, your eyes are not, you know, half the time, like there again, you're not going to, your eyes aren't going to see the sun damage that's coming down right this minute if you don't have sunscreen on. Eventually your eyes will see it. But, you know, in our world, the eyes have a limited ability because they have a range.
Yep.
And so, I mean, that's just something on a physical level to think about. You know, we're silly if we think we know everything. And we have
so for sure.
We're silly. Yeah.
Yep. As it says, I think in the manual, we'd have to be aware of an inconceivably vast range of things, you know, past, present, and to come in order to even begin to make valid judgments about anything and have to take into account everything that, you know, will ever happen or has ever happened and its impact on everyone. It's like, who, you know, I'm paraphrasing again, who is accepting mm-hmm. their wildest fantasies in a position to do this? You know, nobody.
Yes.
So, and as you mentioned the spectra and what our eyes see, you know, we see one octave of light from red through violet out of what could be, you know, at least, you know, in terms of the physics, you know, an almost infinite number of octaves of light. So even in there, even that range, not only are we limited to a tiny portion of the cosmos on this planet, and with an even further with our individual bodies that just have a, you know, maybe 100-year lifespan if we take care of ourselves and a few meters that we can see around us, you know, and we think we have a grasp of reality, you know, get a clue. We're all clueless,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Well, and there again, demonstrations of, you know, being able to see or hear as a barometer of truth. Here's an example. I have a dog who's terrified of thunderstorms. Uh-huh. And probably because she, at some point in her life before I got her, she was abandoned or somehow was lost. And she was in the mountains of Colorado. We don't know for how long.
Uh-huh.
But when she was eventually picked up, you know, then she went into foster care and I adopted her and she's been with me ever since. But she's always scared of thunderstorms. And so the other day I went out with a friend and we were going to walk both my dogs. One doesn't care at all. She'd stand in the middle of a lightning storm if she could. But in any case, the other one, we can't get her out the door. And I mean, it's a little cloudy, but there's nothing going on. And this dog just put her feet down and she would not go. And I just said, well, we're not going to do this. We just dragged her out of the house. So we're trying to get around the block and literally we are just dragging her. And then I heard a sound and I said, was that thunder, you know, in the distance? And my friend said, no, I think that was a car. You know, I think that was a truck or a plane or something. Well, then, of course, a few seconds later, we realized it was thunder. And I thought, no doubt about it, my dog could hear that thunder so much farther away than we could. You know, she heard the thunder before we left the house, which is why she's like, I'm not going out there. But two human beings, we couldn't hear the thunder yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that's just it. Her ears pick up something that is so much farther away. She could pick up something long before I could pick it up.
Yeah.
But it was true. I mean, if you think about, well, when we get into true and reality, we still know we're playing with those words. But you get my drift.
Yeah,
I was listening to my ears, and my ears were not picking up anything.
Right. As metaphors, you know, the animal kingdom are great. Provide great examples. You know, like the acoustic range of smaller animals in the higher ranges that when we can hear, bees apparently see ultraviolet light. We don't see that. I mean, things like that. I mean, so all kinds of examples where, you know, just showing us that we don't, even with our fancy instrumentation, don't really have a clue as to what's going on in the universe.
Yeah.
But, shall I read one more?
Yes, please.
Okay. These eyes made not to see will never see, for the idea they represent left not its maker. Again, the ideas leave not their source, cliche. You know, the ideas of the ego never leave its source, and which is, you know, illusion. And the ideas of truth, which is what we really are, never left its source either, which means that we've never left the heart of perfect oneness. We've never left God. Okay, I'll start that one over again. For the idea they represent left not its maker, and it is their maker that sees through them. What was its maker's goal but not to see? Obviously referring to the ego's goal. Mm-hmm. For this, the body's eyes are perfect means, but not for seeing. See how the body's eyes rest on externals and cannot go beyond. Magic eye poster, anyone?
Yeah.
Watch, or the granite, you know, the metaphor of like, well, I can't, you know, go beyond this little time-space fixation I have with my little personal problems and the what's in it for me insanity that I'm going to, you know, dwell on and go nuts over, right? Well, that's, you know, standard ego fare. Watch how they stop at nothingness, unable to go beyond the form to meaning. Nothing so blinding as perception of form. For sight of form means understanding has been obscured. And it's purposive. I think that's why A Course in Miracles is such a great complement to so many of the truths that have been, you know, handed to us from Eastern mysticism that talk about the world as illusion. Well, A Course in Miracles adds to that the world is illusory because we want to escape from a sin that we think we made. We believe that because we've limited truth to these little tiny Whoville existences and think we're trapped in that, we feel on some level, probably mostly unconscious, horrible about that. And that unconscious guilt really has, according to A Course in Miracles metaphysics, been purposive because that reflects the desire in our mind to try to escape from this untenable, unresolvable, unbearable guilt. That, you know, we're not even consciously aware of for the most part, but we think that we made this cosmic crime and so we need to do something about it. And we appear to have done that by making up a whole universe to hide out in and making, you know, the double shield of oblivion is something we've talked about before, but that's another great metaphor that the Course uses for we think that guilt is real. So we think we needed, to escape from our separate self. And somehow, that we thought we made. And so we need to, kind of bury that further by making up a world where we can take that unconscious guilt and foist it onto everything but us, you know, not in my mind's backyard, so to speak. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was just looking at the chat room, actually. A lot of people are joining in and making a lot of comments, and thank you for that, you know, really on board with this. I just feel like there's just been so many good ideas that have come out of this, you know, just so many good reminders, you know, specifically about, once again, the purpose. And now I'm not going to be able to say it, so I'd have to paraphrase it, but in one of the lessons or somewhere in the text, there is a line that do not underestimate the power of your mind or your thoughts. Uh-huh. And, you know, even because we'd like to say, oh, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't matter, you know, et cetera. And yet here again, contradictory or weaving through different ideas, it's not that you hold yourself responsible for what you see. You hold yourself responsible for what you perceive, for what, how you interpret what you see. And it always is going to come down to, what is your purpose?
Yeah.
You know, is your purpose to see separation? Is your purpose to find guilt in the world? Or is your purpose to find innocence, to remember innocence? And every single thing we do can always kind of come back down to that.
Yeah.
What was my purpose here?
Yeah.
And, you know, somewhere also there again in one of the lessons, it says, ask yourself, what is it for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that first idea was certainly expressed in the early part of the text where Jesus is basically saying, if I were to I'm going to paraphrase it too. If I were to deprive you of your ability to choose, meaning between the two thought systems, I would be giving – you know, depriving you of the most, you know, and denying the most basic law there is, the law of cause and effect, and also denying the power of your mind, and very explicitly pointing that out is that, you know, our minds are phenomenally powerful. We were able to make, not individually, but collectively, an entire cosmos to hide out in from a victimless imaginary crime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty talented.
And, yes.
And so knowing that the real home that we long for is beyond that, you know, frightful, nightmarish world of victims and victimizers, we can, you know, begin to see that our form that we've so cherished and idolized and revered, and, you know, enshrined in monuments and rhapsodized in song and so forth and so on. You know, all those forms, there's nothing wrong with them, but if we can just use those as reminders to get back to the mind, to undo the belief in separation. And as you were pointing out, you know, at the end of the last comment, you know, it really is all about the innocence. And it, you know, A Course in Miracles doesn't ask us to not see the form. It always asks us that we should, would we want to see our brother innocent? Would we want to see each other as not being guilty and in truth, in spirit? Obviously, it's never talking about the level of behavior or actions on a material level. It's always talking about the spiritual, eternal essence that we all are, and asking us to use the specifics to get back to the mind. By seeing where the irritation is, where the annoyances are, where the frustrations and the depressions and the angers and all those things that are the triggers that say, aha, I've got invested in the form again. If I'm experiencing those kind of thoughts and feelings, I must have chosen the wrong teacher. I must have chosen the teacher of guilt instead of the teacher of kindness and innocence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think another real take-home point from today in this discussion is that idea that at any given time, we're looking at a very, very, very tiny piece of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
That alone is helpful to me. If I could just remember that, I'm looking at a very, very tiny piece of the picture. Because here, again, we've been talking about this the last month or so, and I say we, I kind of collectively, you know, the group that is following this show, and sometimes it's Susan Dugan, sometimes it's Bruce, sometimes it's, you know, listening to Ken Wapnick. But this idea that I just don't have all the information I need to make good choices or decisions, that I really am limited, you know, and it was one of those lessons. I can't remember now if you and I did it or Susan and I did it, but just that we don't know what's in our best interest.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that is such a hard thing because, you know, I spend my day thinking I know what's in my best interest or somebody else's best interest. Why don't you do this? You should do that. And What are you doing that for? You know, it's like I pride myself on you know, being such a good, you know, decision maker that way. And, you know, and it kind of goes back to, you know, when we were talking about the judgment, is that what the world considers good judgment is based on experience in the world. Mm-hmm. And as Ken said, so it's an insane asylum. And so now you're telling me you've gotten really, really good at the rules of the insane asylum.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So wisdom, you know, and I don't dismiss it. You know, I do consider in the world there's something to be said for being able to navigate the world successfully. But navigating the world successfully doesn't equate to contentment or satisfaction or happiness if we're always looking at the externals. Those things will always leave us unsatisfied. No matter how good we get at manipulating the rules of the world, we will never be satisfied. Because there will always be that place within us, as you said before, that wants to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want something else.
Yeah.
So just, you know, like I said, to me, I almost see this visual of this big circle and this little black dot in the middle of it. And that's all I know at this point.
And yeah.
I think that black dot is everything there is to know, but it's not. That's only seeing a very, very tiny piece.
Exactly. That's like our little Whoville world. Have you ever seen Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who?
Yeah. I mean,
and realize that the ego's world is like that little speck of dust that floats past the elephant's ear that he just happens to hear this cry for help from, you know. But it's really, you know, it's in relative metaphors, it's that, you know, scale of insanity to think that the little dust mote is somehow compromising our innocence. And no, we're just, it's really just one actor on an infinite stage that mm-hmm. appears to be multiple actors holding hands, taking a bow, looking back on this little Whoville production. Another thing that crossed my mind as you're speaking, Sia, a moment ago, about, you know, ascribing meaning based on, you know, interpreting from within the dream as a dream figure, you know, we were using a false set of measurements.
Yes.
And there was a illustration that a teacher of mine, when I was an undergraduate at University of California, Davis, I was fortunate to take several classes from Charles Tart, who coined the phrase altered states of consciousness and wrote a very scholarly book on the subject and some things on Gurdjieff and humanistic psychology. And one of his classes, I don't remember where. In fact, I learned later that he is actually a colleague of D. Patrick Miller, who helped Gary Renard publish his book.
Oh, yeah.
And also a course student. So, but he may have been a course student while I was an undergraduate and before I even got into the course, but I don't know. Anyway, he put this illustration, very simple illustration on the chalkboard in one of his classes, and he drew a slightly curved line, and then he drew a slightly curved ruler that perfectly matched the slope of that slightly curved line underneath it and he says, I can hold this ruler up and say, see, I just proved that this is a straight line. And of course the whole class laughed, but it made a good point. It's like, you know, we use a faulty system of measurement to draw faulty conclusions. You know, our whole premise, you know, as chapter 21 suggests, you know,
projection makes perception.
Yeah, exactly. But your basis for inference is wrong. Your cues for inference are wrong. I think that's what
it's. Yes.
And I think what a great reminder. And it's such a simple little short thing that says, you know, our whole foundation for making any kind of judgment is just, it's just silly, because we're seeing not only a tiny portion of a dream, let alone reality, but we're also seeing it in a very distorted way, in the same way that, you know, we turn a pair of binoculars backwards and, you know, that's what enables
us. And things go far away. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what enables us to, in the classic kids joke of how to capture an elephant with a jar, a pair of tweezers and a pair of binoculars. Well, you turn the binoculars backwards so that the elephant looks tiny. Then you open up the jar, take the tweezers, drop the elephant in and close the lid. Right.
So that's
real simple.
Yes. Well, and I'll tell you what, even though time is an illusion, right now we have to pay attention to time, and it's time to close the show. So in 1 minute, would you like to make any announcement or refer people to any place you'd like to? And of course, you know, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, I always do that. I post it in the website or on the You know, in Facebook, et cetera. So yes. I would tell people go to facim.org, and you can even search on this topic and find some talks that Ken has given. But do you have any quick announcements, Bruce?
I would always add to that the Foundation for Inner Peace website, the sister organization for Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which is their website for FIP is acim.org. So it's a real easy mnemonic is facim.org for the teaching organization that Ken headed up for many years. And acim.org, without the F, for the Foundation for Inner Peace. And both have a wealth of information of great value to course students. Also, miracleshare.org. I've been helping with the October online virtual conference on A Course in Miracles that's coming up in October. We're almost ready to make the announcements for people to sign up if they want to attend this 3-day virtual conference, which you obviously can attend after the fact if you can't make it because it's virtual. And I'll have details for that on my website, which is acimblog.com. So anyway, thank you, CA, as always. And it's always a delight to share with you. And I need these reminders, and I find them very helpful.
Okay. Well, same here, Bruce. I love it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'll talk to you next month. I'll post some of these things in the chat room. And everybody, thank you for joining me there. Thanks to all the listeners. And thanks to Scott Weaver, our producer today. So I hope that you will stay tuned. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. Keep it tuned to 1-2 Radio. You have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and my guest Bruce Rawls on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.